It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Milwaukee's mayor seeks to replace all of the city's lead pipes over the next two decades with a boost in federal funding to expedite the timeline, we discuss programs underway in the state health department to prevent lead poisoning in children. Call in with a question or a comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Weaver is lead policy advisor for the State Department of Health Services. Brian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So Wisconsin on track to receive almost $370 million to replace lead water pipes through the federal bipartisan infrastructure law. What effect could this have on public health in Wisconsin?
Well, it's a critically important investment to support the overall population health of Wisconsinites, and particularly of the very young in Wisconsin. Childhood lead poisoning is a significant issue in Wisconsin. It is a state that has an older housing stock and older infrastructure, and so lead contamination can happen in homes across the state. And Wisconsin has on average, over 3,500 lead poisoned children annually in the state. So it is a serious public health threat.
Are there places in the state where lead pipes are more common?
Yeah, we'll find lead pipes where, again, there's older infrastructure. We have the city of Milwaukee that has many of the older lead service lines still in operation, but we can find those across the state. And it is a high need as far as the lead service line replacement, getting those replaced in all locations, particularly on the, when they do this, making sure those replacements are happening both on the government-owned public side, but also the private side, the homeowner side. So when those lead service lines are replaced, replace both sides of those through of the contamination.
Brian, we're having some difficulty hearing you, so we're going to switch to a better line as we talk about preventing lead exposure. Brian Weaver is lead policy advisor for the State Health Department, and you can join in with your questions, your comments about lead exposure, lead pipes, and prevention steps that you have taken at your home. Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org as we explore programs in Wisconsin to reduce the hazards of lead in homes and businesses, and in terms of how to help more children ensure that they do not have high lead levels. Again, 800-642-1234. Brian, can you hear us now? Hi, Brian, can you hear us now? I think we're, Brian, are you there?
I'm connecting.
All right, Brian. I'm sorry, we're having some difficulty hearing Brian Weaver as we discuss lead poisoning in children and looking at policies and programs here in Wisconsin to ensure that,
Okay.
Oh, here we go. Brian Weaver, are you there?
Yes, apologies. I don't know what's happening on my end.
That's okay. Now you're much better, loud and clear.
How
at risk are adults compared to children for damaging lead exposure?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the reason being is that it's kind of a different scenario that we're seeing with adults. So when we see lead poisoning in the adult population, it is most often related to occupational hazard, or could even be a hobby that involves using lead. So stained glass work, but primarily where we're seeing this in the adult population, if they're working in an occupation that involves lead, a battery factory, many years ago, there was lead poisoning cases at a shipyard where they were removing lead-based paint from vessels. And so that's where we'll see the poisoning in the adult population. It really is a childhood disease, something that we're seeing largely impacts the very young children, typically under the age of 2 and younger, where we're seeing most of the lead poisoning cases in the state.
What are the long-term effects of lead poisoning in children?
Yeah, so the health effects and of exposure are really harmful in very young children, where they're still developing, their brains are developing, they're growing rapidly. So we do see children at that age really being impacted the most. So even low levels of lead in the blood have been associated with decreased intelligence, behavioral difficulties, and hearing and speech problems. And it's believed that the neurological and behavioral effects of lead poisoning are irreversible too. So it's really important to prevent this exposure in young children. And if they are exposed and become lead poisoned, to catch it early. So blood lead testing is critically important among the very young children to ensure that they are not being exposed to lead in their environment.
There was a study last year of 26,000 children and found that black children had disproportionately elevated levels of lead in their blood. Why are children of color more at risk for lead poisoning?
Yeah, what we find in Wisconsin, where we have the highest rates in the city of Milwaukee, and it is correct, in Wisconsin, black children who are tested for lead are 4 times greater odds of having lead poisoning than white children. And what we find in Wisconsin is that the scenario that we see most often where children are lead poisoned is that these children are living in rental properties that are pre-1950. So they have a lot of lead-based paint in them. Interior and exterior of the home, these properties are not well maintained. And so there's chipping, peeling, flaking paint that happens inside and outside of the home. And often the families who find themselves in these situations just have fewer options as far as affordable, safe, and decent housing. And so they end up in these homes that have lead hazards, lead paint hazards, and their small children are being exposed to it. So we see this being played over and over again in the cities of Milwaukee and other locations in Wisconsin, where a lot of times the lead exposure is happening in these properties where they are not well maintained, and we have that chipping, peeling, flaking paint that's exposing these small children to that lead.
I would imagine if a home has lead paint, that rules out your ability to do any sanding or scraping or doing like demo work without some remediation. How do you remediate lead paint from your home?
Yeah, so it's really important to get someone who is certified and qualified, that's been trained to safely and effectively remove lead-based paint. We have lead workers across the state who have been certified by the state of Wisconsin to do this work in a safe manner so it doesn't expose the workers, the family members, and anyone in the neighborhood near these homes, properties, to the lead-based paint. So it's really important if someone is wanting to do some renovation to reach out to their local health department to have that property assessed. That is a you do need someone certified to actually assess the lead-based paint in that property. So it's critically important to work with the qualified workers and the local health department to make sure that work is done safely.
With lead being colorless and tasteless, returning to water here, how would I know whether my drinking water contains lead?
Well, that's part of the problem with lead is that it is not something that people are going to know that they're being exposed to. And that's true for lead paint dust, lead contaminated drinking water. So it's critically important to have that tested. So if someone is concerned about having lead in their service lines or in their plumbing fixtures, then they feel like they're potentially being exposed to lead. The only way you can find out is testing that. Your local water utility can help out with testing of water. In addition to that, I always do recommend reaching out to the local health department again, because it's if you're dealing with potentially lead contaminated water, you might be in an older building. It might be important to assess the property as a whole for other lead risk hazards.
Brian Weaver, lead policy advisor for the State Department of Health Services, as we discuss sources of lead poisoning, prevention programs underway. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Milwaukee seeks to replace its thousands of lead pipes in a 20-year time horizon, we examine programs underway at the State Health Department to prevent lead poisoning and eliminate lead hazards in homes. Call in with a question or concern, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Weaver is here, lead policy advisor for the State Department of Health Services. Brian, Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson talked about a strategy this week to prioritize streets on which a child has been diagnosed with elevated lead levels. How would you propose cities prioritize what order to replace their lead service lines?
That actually is a good start. We have a program at the state called the Lead Safe Homes Program, and we take a similar approach where that program abates lead paint hazards in homes, properties. We prioritize properties where there's been a lead poisoned child. And the reason why that makes sense is that, one, you want to prevent further exposure of lead to that child who's been poisoned. And knowing that potentially that property could be a property that has multiple children in it, or could be down the road you're looking at kind of generational health, that making sure that any other family that moves into that property, that children not being exposed to lead hazards. So prioritizing where there's been lead poisoned children does make sense. Older properties, pre-1950 homes, that would be another way to look at prioritizing properties to focus in on looking at those properties that have an older infrastructure, mm-hmm. as far as lead laterals, as well as having the kind of original paint on the property and hasn't been lead abated. Those would be properties that could be prioritized in this rollout.
You mentioned our state's lead safe Wisconsin program, that umbrella program. What services are becoming more effective to reduce lead hazards and exposure? What is working as part of Lead Safe Wisconsin?
Well, first and foremost, our local health departments have been on the front line for 30 years addressing the issue of childhood lead poisoning. So what has worked well is that kind of consistent being in the community, educating young parents about the importance of having a clean and safe, healthy environment where children can live, learn, and play in is critically important. So educating families, we have working with the health department, responding to children who have been lead poisoned to make sure they have the proper case management and follow-up services. In addition to that, our department also regulates lead-based paint work in homes and childcare centers, and we train and certify those lead workers who work in those properties to do lead safe renovation or lead abatement work. So our role is to make sure that work is done properly and the people are certified and trained correctly to do that work safely. And then in addition to that, we have our Lead Safe Homes program, which is really the first program of its kind in Wisconsin that's focused specifically on removing lead-based paint hazards in older homes across the state. That was is a Governor Evers initiative that he led, and we're looking to actually in Wisconsin expand that opportunity through some recently signed bills supporting rehabbing older homes in Wisconsin. That was a kind of a bipartisan effort to put additional funding out there to fix up older properties. Now it's more than just lead-based paint, but that is one element of it. So what's critically important is to make sure we get into these properties, address any lead paint hazards, any other lead hazards on that property before children are exposed to those hazards and become poisoned.
Would these be through grants that residents could go after, or how would that work?
Yeah, so the Lead Safe Homes program is targeted at Medicaid-enrolled families. And it's, again, targeted at children who have been lead poisoned, families who have children who have been lead poisoned. So that is part of the enrollment process, but also we do go out and work locally with health departments and other housing agencies to determine where the need is to focus on what properties need to be worked on. The larger housing rehabilitation funding that's coming out during this fiscal year is it's not has not been determined yet. Those dollars are not available quite yet. That program is being built as we speak. So I think the goal is for a large percentage of those dollars to go out as low interest or forgivable loans for qualified applicants. Again, those details still need to be worked out.
We'll be watching that. Yes. Brian Weaver leads lead policy advisor for the state health department. You can call in with your questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Brian, we heard from Linda in Milwaukee and wants to know, what is the cost of testing for lead?
Well, that I actually don't have the exact number on. So it's going to vary depending on who does the testing. And how the testing is done. There are programs out there, particularly for testing water, where you can get some families can get support on testing their water. But you're really going to have to work with your local water utility to determine the cost of that test. And then to test lead paint in a property, we would again recommend you reaching out to your local health department because you need a lead risk assessor to determine to do that testing for you as well. So there is a cost associated with testing for lead, but again, looking into those services, individuals may qualify for assistance to complete that work.
Going back in time here, when you came on our program in March last year, you had said the number of blood lead level testing for children was falling due to the pandemic. Is that drop in blood tests still the case?
Unfortunately, yes, it is. We are still at about 25 percent fewer tests, blood lead tests occurring in young children pre-COVID. Those numbers still have not rebounded to where we want them to be at as far as testing goes. So that is something we've been working on really closely with partners at within the Department of Health Services and at the local level and with healthcare partners to determine ways we can get more children tested for lead, particularly at the ages of 1 and 2, which are the two key time points that we want to make sure that all children in Wisconsin are being tested for lead.
Let's go to Vern in Eau Claire County. Vern, hi.
Oh, good morning. Yeah. Like I said, they put fluoric acid and chlorine in the water, and you got two of the most powerful halogens that dissolve some lead. So, and the lead was in the pipes because the plumbers' unions and the lead mining companies got together and they forced the cities to adopt a zoning regulation where you had to use lead pipes. Then you got all the lead soldered copper in the houses, plus you got zinc in the water lines. But if you drink milk, that tends to be the same.
Vern, we're short on time here, and Vern really points to a compounding problem over the decades to what you're trying to address now, Brian.
Yeah, I guess my response would be that, the rollout and replacement of lead service lines is been critically important. There's been state investment. There's a pretty strong federal investment now in removing those lead service lines across the state. And partners that we work with, actually who lead this work, the Department of Natural Resources, really have been leading the nation in making sure that municipalities, water utilities have both the support they need, the technical assistance, and the funding to effectively remove lead service lines from the water
in
network.
In our last moments together, other than paint and pipes, how else could people be exposed to lead?
Yeah, I mean, that's important to understand. Again, paint and lead contaminated water are the two primary sources. We have seen cases where imported cosmetics, candies, medicines have led to lead poisoning in small children. Mm-hmm. So those typically are discovered through the lead investigation that health departments lead when they have a lead poisoned child. They will go in and talk
Do
with the family.
Investigation. And... Yes.
Yep.
Brian, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Brian Weaver is lead policy advisor for the State Department of Health Services. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A pediatrician gives tips on a healthy return to school this fall. And you can be part of the conversation as we discuss children's health and a positive start in the classroom. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Emily Riedinger is an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Riedinger, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. The Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association requires student athletes to have a physical before participating in school sports, and this back-to-school surge can lead to a backlog in doctor's offices. Where can parents go to get their kids a physical when clinics are booked?
I think the first step is really to call your clinic, and certainly in our health system and most health systems around the state, we are doing everything we can to get kids in before their sports start, which for many kids has already happened. And that's included adding on extra clinics and opening up some slots. And so the first step is really to call your child's care office and see what other options they might have. There are a couple private groups around the state who offer health physicals, or sports physicals, I should say. One caution to parents is just to remember that really those are targeted sports physicals and are not meant to replace their well check, where we cover many other things, including growth and developmental assessments and anticipatory guidance. And for adolescents, asking about other health behaviors that might be really impactful on their health and screening for mental health. And so if folks use one of those clinics, they want to make sure to also schedule an annual visit, which may be less urgent once they have that sports form, at a time that their clinic has an opening. So all of those things can be covered as well. And then for folks who may not have the resources to access some of these private clinics, there are some free clinics which will vary throughout the state, and their pediatrician's office might be able to help direct them. And we really do try to reserve those for youth who may not be able to access healthcare in other ways and really need that kind of free or very reduced cost option.
What I appreciate as a parent is that the clinic stocks the appropriate paperwork that the child will need from the school district. And it must be like the school district is proactive in ensuring the pediatric clinics have the paperwork so that if the parent forgets to bring it, it is there in the clinic, which happened at our visit. And I was just so appreciative of that ability to come up behind me and say, we got you on that form.
Totally. I'm a parent, too, and have definitely forgotten my forms before. I think something nice is that in the state of Wisconsin, the WIAA form is standardized. So most clinics are able to stock that. And at least at the, K-12 level, that's accepted at pretty much every public school, at least across the state, and most private schools as well. Once you get to the college level for our college athletes, some schools have their own specific forms, but those are often available on an online portal. So even if somebody forgets them, usually we can figure it out in the visit.
Perfect. That standardization really, really helps parents. Turning now the clocks back to the bedtime off the summer months. The National Center for Education Statistics says Wisconsin's public schools on average start at 7:54 a.m. When should parents start transitioning kids' bedtimes earlier?
Now. This is something we're doing in our household, too, and I've been talking with parents and families about the last couple of weeks. You know, ideally, kids are going to be ready to go in the morning on that first day of school. There's enough stress and jitters that night before that might make that night of sleep a little bit more difficult. And if they're also trying to make that shift in the night or two just before school, I think it's not optimal. And so, you know, starting that shift now, which really also begins with getting them out of bed earlier so that they're more tired in the evening, and usually going through a phase of a couple days at least, and sometimes longer, where kids are a little bit more tired and cranky during the day because they got up earlier and went to bed later and haven't made the shift yet. It's so much better if that can happen at home than on those first few days of school, where teachers are working hard to try to set up that classroom community and set expectations and do a lot of important things that kids need to be present for.
That is a great insight there. Like, setting a morning alarm clock now really helps them start to even adjust to hearing that alarm go off and what it sounds like and what it feels like. But thinking about not just the night activities, but the morning as well in you know, trying to ease that transition.
Absolutely. Starting with that getting up and figuring out, you know, especially for kids who may have maybe starting newly to school, you know, our kindergartners and stuff. Gee, how long is that morning routine going to take with this child, and getting a sense of that so that those first couple of days don't feel like a total scramble.
Timing the walk to the bus stop as well.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Dr. Emily Riedinger, pediatrician at UW Health, as we talk about back to school pediatrics advice as well along the way. You can call in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Going into flu season, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say COVID-19 hospitalizations are up nationally by more than 14% from last week. What is your advice for parents who are considering whether to vaccinate their children?
I think, you know, I recommend vaccination. I have vaccinated my own children. We know, you know, both from research and I can say what I'm seeing in my own practice too, that we're seeing more long COVID symptoms in children. And to me, that's, you know, one of the most concerning pieces. Many children will fare well. Children are pretty resilient unless they have underlying health conditions with the kind of acute phase of COVID when they're actually sick. And I hear a lot of parents say that and say, I'm not sure I want to vaccinate because my kid will likely do well with COVID. And although that may be true, I think there's a lot about the long-term effects of COVID that we don't totally know and understand yet. And research is ongoing, but viral infections can have long-term impacts, not just the long COVID and fatigue, which I'm seeing children with who were previously completely healthy. And that can be really debilitating for them and for their family. And I can't predict who that's going to impact. But there are longer term effects of some viruses too. And I think we don't fully understand that from COVID. So the best thing that people can do to help protect their child and their community and the other children in the classroom community, some of whom may have special healthcare needs, is to vaccinate.
I know it's early here, but do you have any indications that whether the COVID booster and the flu vaccine might be paired together, or will they need separate clinic visits? What do you anticipate?
I suspect they'll be able to be done in one visit. So the you know, science that we have right now suggests that giving the COVID vaccine along with other vaccines is perfectly safe. And so I think the hope and anticipation is that children will be able to get their COVID booster and their flu vaccine in one visit, not combined, unfortunately, into one, you know, one poke just yet. That might be a future hope for children anyways.
Yes.
But at least at the same visit, which I think is nicer for children and families when it's kind of one and done visit.
In terms of that visit, something that's been on my mind, when preteens and teens go for that well check, should older kids start going into their clinic visit with their pediatrician alone? When do they stop needing us? Or how do you suggest approaching that independence in the pediatric setting?
Yeah. I love this question because I think it really is important for teens to start developing the skills and ability to lead some of their healthcare independently. And that should be done in a supported way. So, you know, if a parent or caregiver is able to come to the visit, for all teens, I think that's very important. And, you know, once kids reach age 12 or 13, typically some portion of the visit is done independently. And this really helps them build that skill so that when they take that next step in their life, whether it's off to college or the workforce or the military or whatever they decide to do, the next time they see a doctor isn't the first time that they've seen a doctor alone. Mm-hmm. But we wouldn't expect a 12 or 13 year old to know what to do. And that gives us a number of years to really help kind of build that skill and build that stamina. And then, you know, so there are some sensitive questions, and absolutely, I 100% encourage very open communication between adolescents and their parents. And there are some things that kids are more comfortable talking about with their parent outside of the room, and that's okay too. So it gives us as pediatricians a chance to explore some of those topics and make sure that kids are being safe and healthy in all aspects of their life.
There's the new study by your colleague, Dr. Megan Moreno, saying teens are more likely to practice safer online behavior after receiving brief clinical advice. How do you talk to kids about social media?
I typically ask kids what they're using and what they're using it for. And I think that's a really critical conversation, not only with pediatricians and other healthcare providers, but also, you know, with parents. And I think sometimes we focus on time, how much time is a child spending or a teen spending on social media, rather than on kind of quality of that use. And there are some things that, you know, screen time and internet use and social media use can have benefit for, or is this kind of mindless scrolling that's taking away from engagement in other activities that might ultimately bring them more joy and improve mental health and be good for their well-being. And so I try to explore the motivation behind the amount of time that they're spending on it and what they're getting out of it. Mm. And the flip side of that, what they might be missing out on if that usage is kind of low quality and voluminous.
Really kind of exploring that environment as to when and how they're using it. Pediatrician Emily Riedinger at UW Health Kids, as we explore what's on your mind about how to give a child a strong start to the new school year, and there's room to discuss. Call in with a question, share what's on your mind, your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore steps to a healthy start this school year, and we have Dr. Emily Riedinger fielding your questions about the health and well-being of children and teens. You can call in now with a question or comment for the pediatrician, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Okay, let's turn to food here. The National Institutes of Health says schools often ban peanut products like peanut butter in an attempt to avoid allergic reactions in kids. So is a peanut ban necessary?
I think that's very situation dependent. For, you know, some children, unfortunately, being in an environment where there are peanuts at all can be deadly. And for many children with peanut allergies, it's more about avoiding contact themselves. nuts and peanuts and other legumes can be great sources of protein and healthy fats. And certainly a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is a convenient lunch to pack for your child. And in some schools or classrooms, that may not be feasible. And I think that's a good moment to talk with children who may be disappointed about that, about the importance of thinking about others around you and kind of being a good community member. And in some schools or classrooms, it might be perfectly fine, even if there are children with peanut allergies, as long as they're not consuming them themselves. So I'm not sure there's a one size fits all answer to that question and may really depend on the situation. I would say in most, but not all, it's likely to be okay to have it in the classroom as long as the child who has the allergy isn't in contact. But there are definitely kids for whom that could be a life-threatening situation. And that's something, of course, we want to avoid for those around us, is putting someone else in that situation.
Oh, I like that one. I'm going to use that. Being a good citizen and being a good peer to a fellow classmate. I really appreciate that. How can parents ensure their children are eating healthy throughout the day, especially when lunchtimes can be really condensed and short?
Oh my gosh, yes, lunchtimes can be so short. I was a slow eater as a child, and one of my kids is a very slow eater. Starting off with a good breakfast, if they eat breakfast at home, is a wonderful option. And making sure that there's some protein in there and kind of a mix of different food groups. So I think about trying to get a protein, a grain, a produce, and a fat into my child every morning before they get out the door. And I'll confess, particularly as a kind of dual working household, boy, that's not always possible for us. And so I think at a broader level, the more that we can work to have those nutritious meals delivered in the school so that all students, including those who rely on schools for their meals, are receiving well-rounded, healthy, nutritious foods that get them off to a good start is, again, another great way that we can all be kind of stewards of all the children, not just our own. And some of that starts with thinking about how school lunches are funded and the funding for schools in general, and kind of when it comes time to go to the polls, voting for folks whose policies will be supporting the health of children is something that we can all do.
Those school lunches and school breakfasts as well, so important to kids and their ability to learn. How much is that tied to learning then, having that proper nutrition in those meals?
Boy, you know, we've all been hangry at times in our lives where, you know, we haven't had enough to eat or had something that was a very kind of sugary or fast nutrition sort of food. And then you get that crash. And that happens to kids too. And that's one of the reasons why it's really important to have those healthy proteins and healthy fats in the morning too, and at lunchtime. And that absolutely impacts learning and ability to concentrate and perform well. I think that nutrition is one of those key building blocks, you know, nutrition, sleep, body movement, all of those things are crucial to helping our kids learn throughout the day.
Nutrition, sleep, body movement. Dr. Emily Riedinger with us from UW Health as we talk back to school fundamentals and get pediatric advice. You can join in with your questions and comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Turning to mental health, Governor Tony Evers calling this year the year of mental health. What mental health signs or signals should parents watch for as kids go back to school?
It's a stressful time for a lot of children, many emotions, kind of a return to seeing peers that they may not have seen for a while. Keeping those open lines of communication with kids for young kids that may be really direct and concrete questions, vague questions like, how was your day, can be hard for little
fine.
Kids to answer.
The one word fine is something
exactly. Yeah. Yep, I get that a lot. And so I try to be more specific with young kids, like, who did you sit next to at lunch and what did you talk about? Tell me what book you're reading in, you know, group reading time. And those concrete questions are just easier for young kids. For older kids, it might be more about creating space for them to talk to you about what they want to talk about and letting them know that you are there and available. Oftentimes it's easier for kids to talk if they're kind of next to you, but maybe not looking directly at you. So that might be creating space to have a family walk together or when you're riding in the car. And then we know that for all kids and adolescents in particular, family meals are one of the most powerful things that parents can do to support their child's mental health. It does not have to be anything fancy, but family meals are so good beyond nutrition. They've been associated with lower risk-taking behaviors, improved mental health and stuff. And it just creates that opportunity for people to be together and give them that space to talk about what they might have on their minds.
You know, we hear that phrase that a kid is just going through a certain phase, but how long should you let certain new behaviors linger? How do you know it's not a phase?
I think if you're unsure, please call your pediatrician or healthcare provider. And, you know, we're the developmental experts and we can try to help you tease some of that out. But parents are the first line. And if you're worried, it is always right to ask us, ask your teen, try to figure out what's going on. And I think it's, you know, there's no specific line that one crosses, but boy, most parents or caregivers know their child pretty well. And if you're saying this is way outside of the norm, trust your instincts.
The National Education Association says fewer than 40% of public schools employ a full-time registered nurse. What are the benefits of having a school nurse at schools?
Well, it allows kids to have a space and place to go if they're feeling unwell and have some expert evaluation for, you know, injuries that might occur or illness that might occur. School nurses also do a fabulous job of helping recognize and understand kids who may be at risk for certain illnesses, ensuring that, you know, school policies align with what we know is appropriate for health. And thinking about things like vaccination and infection control procedures and stuff like that. So I know I've had more than one phone conversation with the school nurse at my children's school, and they feel very reassured too, knowing that if they get sick during the day, there's someone there who knows and is able to take care of them until we can get there to pick them up.
Yeah, certainly so important as you look at the health and well-being of kids in the school environment. Dr. Riedinger, thank you so much for joining us with these insights.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Emily Riedinger is an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And if you missed any part of our conversation, you can also stream or download a recording later today. It's at WPR.org/mornings. While you're there, you can visit a lot of our other conversations at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.